Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahulastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a man. It's 2022 and he's remote podcasting by choices, Richard Herring. Hello, my finest friends. This is very weird. Welcome to remote Richard Herring's Lardar Seditious Traitor podcast. We're recording this on January the 6th, 2022. So as a little tribute to Donald Trump and his fans. I'm naming it after him. So I was talking to the insurrection of January the 6th, 2021 the other day, and Jake Angeli, the QAnon shaman, as he's sometimes known, he calls it Rahulastapa. So I call QAnon Quanon. So, you know, we're equal on that. Yes, it's the first remote one we've done for what feels like years. We have an international guest. But we have a little gap where we haven't got any live ones to put out. So I think we might try and do a few more of these with international guests. It's very exciting. We are doing some more live ones very soon. Look at richherring.com/gigs and you can find out about that. We're going to be at the Phoenix in Oxford Circus and for 2 weeks. And we're going to be at the Leicester Comedy Festival. We're going to be at the Bristol Slapstick Festival. And then we're back at the Leicester Square Theatre and we're live streaming those. So you can watch them anywhere in the world. The Kickstarter is still going. It's hit its target. Rahulastapa.co.uk/Kickstarter if you want to get a season pass or any of the extras. But you don't have to. But you won't be able to get the season pass. After that Kickstarter is over, you'll have to pay for individual episodes if you want to live stream. Up to you. Anyway, looking at the news, I'm able to look at the news because this one's going out almost immediately. The story about the little baby from Nirvana, Spencer Eldon is called. He had made a failed attempt to sue Nirvana for sexual exploitation because you'll see there his baby Winky is clearly displayed on the cover of Nevermind there. And I expect a lot of people masturbated over that image. The rest of him's there as well. It's not just his winky, then it would be sexual exploitation. The most surprising bit of the story that I saw, though, was that he has used the people arguing against his argument. He failed to sue Nirvana because it's ridiculous. And the opposing lawyers said he has used his connection to try to pick up women, the word try is doing a lot of work there. And it's noteworthy he has never used the connection to successfully pick up a woman because who would be into that? Do you want to have sex with the baby from Nevermind? No, mate, I don't really fancy that at all. No, wait, no, now he's grown up, I mean. But you've put the thought of him
by which I assume you mean you, being a baby, and I wouldn't be able to shake that now, because of your approach to this, I'll be thinking I'm having sex with the Nevermind baby while it's happening, and I'm sorry, that's not something I'm into. Good luck in your quest to find a woman who is turned on by baby dicks. No, all I'm saying is I'm famous. I'm the baby from the cover. So you claim, but anyone could say that. But also, even if it is you, you're only famous for being a baby. So I'm going to try and help you out of here. Don't ever use this as a chat-up line again. I thought women like babies. That's a bit of a generalisation. And even if it's true, I would say practically none of them like to have sex with babies or to have a conversation with someone who makes them think about that. I'd say it was one of our main turn-offs. You don't know what you're missing. I'm missing out on having sex with a man whose main achievement was being unknowingly dunked in some water and who decades later has nothing else he can try and impress strangers with. Hold on, I tried to sue Nirvana for sexual exploitation. Who would try and exploit a baby in a way to get people to like them? Oh, wait, I hear it now. My bad. just remember this. All the people you'll ever have sex with were once babies, so you're not so perfect yourself. In fact, I'm going to sue you for sexual exploitation. Anyway, there you go. There's my... Apparently, I wrote all that, and then someone tweeted me and said, apparently his actual chat-up line was, would you like to see my penis again? Which is possibly much worse than what I just imagined. The other great news, which I will just quickly look at from this week, is the 90 Day Fiancé star, I don't know what that is, because I'm an old man, made £38,000 a week selling farts in a jar, was been hospitalised because she thought she was having a stroke. I've got the story here. I'll bring my other computer across. It's hot off the presses. She's got 260,000 followers, and she charges $1,000 for a fart in a jar. Now, you know, I've just mentioned my Kickstarter, and this is giving me ideas. If someone will pay $1,000, I mean, her farts are probably quite nice smelling. Mine smell awful. I've just did one when just before my guest came on and really smelt. So I could get that in a jar for you. She was hospitalized after, because she'd been eating like stuff to try and make her fart. And then she got anxious, and then she had to go to hospital she thought she was going to die. I was advised to change my diet and to take a gas suppressant medication, which effectively ended my business. So now what she's doing, instead of selling her own farts, she's selling digital artworks on a blockchain of her farts, which I hope will still sell for $1,000. Absolutely incredible. But, you know, who am I to talk after all the Kickstarter things I've put you through? And that might be next. Hope you're having a good 2002. I didn't stay up for the new year. I went to bed at 9 o'clock because we were really tired. But I was woken at about 1 o'clock in the morning. My start to the year 2002 was my son having a prodigious nosebleed. He said he needed to blow his nose. So I gave him some tissue in the dark. He blew his nose. He handed it back and it was black and I couldn't understand what was going on. And then I turned on the lights and there was blood everywhere. So I don't know if that's symbolic of what's coming for 2022, everyone. Let's hope not. I hope not. Although we were having Christmas dinner or a couple of days after Christmas dinner and everyone was joking around. The adults and the kids were all together. And Ernie was doing lots of poo jokes and laughing, joining in the conversation. And I said, come on, Ernie, that's enough. That's enough with the poo jokes. And then he kind of, like a real comedian would, suddenly he crumpled and he said, I don't know any adult jokes, so I have to do poo jokes. And he said it so sadly. And it was like, it was just the heart of a comedian. That's exactly, I mean, you know, I could have said that quite easily myself. there we go. It was a beautiful moment and I felt bad. So, oh, sorry, put the wrong thing on. Still getting used to this. That's what I want. It was a beautiful moment. And very telling. He's going to be a comedian and he's just going to be one like his dad, unfortunately for him. Look, let's crack on. My guest this week, he's been on before. He's probably best known as the traffic warden in Grimsby. That's what we've all seen him doing. That's why we're here today to watch this. Will you please welcome, he's too gorgeous, it's Peter Bainham. Here he is. How are you doing?
I'm good. I've actually tried to pick up women by saying I'm the traffic warden in Grimsby.
And how's that?
Is
that?
And then I said I told them I was exploited by being, when I was much younger, by used as the traffic warden in Grimsby.
Rob Brydon was the traffic warden in Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, and that was sort of the part that projected into fame. So I wondered if being a traffic warden in Grimsby had the same... The Brothers Grimm, it was called. Was it called the Brothers Grimm in the UK?
It was called the Brothers Grimsby.
I think in the US.
Right.
Which I never really understood. And then Grimsby in the UK.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Because they don't know what Grimsby is, do they? So that's. But then Grimsby's still in the title the other way, so
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Any funny stories from your time on the set at in Grimsby?
No. No, I'm not very good with funny stories. Just trying to think.
I didn't think there would be.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't out of all the Sacha Baron Cohen films, that was arguably the least successful one.
It was inarguably. It was. Do you think? There's very hard evidence for that, Rich. there's more. It's very clear. No, I remember.
Do you feel it was because of you that's what jinxed it?
I think, yeah. I think if they'd taken out my writing, but obviously also the traffic warden scene is what, destroyed it. I do remember getting a phone call on the morning. Not that box office is the only measure of a movie's quality or success, but although it's a very useful one. And I remember getting a call on the Saturday morning to be told how it had done and telling my wife, Sarah, and she just laughed. just the only appropriate response, and how unbelievably it badly it had done. So
strange business, isn't it? Because it's the same team, the same writers and the same star.
Yeah, I know.
Just sometimes something flies, and sometimes it doesn't.
And yet you have I was approached at my wife's uncle Don's memorial service in Wisconsin in the summer. By a woman who said, will you please speak to my son, who's a giant fan of the Brothers Grimsby, and took me over to this big, shaking 15-year-old boy who was a giant, giant fan of it. I think it has got a fan base in 15-year-old boys, you know, which is obviously where it was aimed.
To be honest, I didn't watch that one for research on that. It's one of the ones I haven't seen. I have seen pretty much everything else you've done.
It's got some funny scenes in it, but it didn't. Yeah, yeah, whatever. It wasn't
I'm not here just to pick up all the things that have gone badly for you, Pete. I know you've got a very successful career, and I'm not just going to concentrate.
Oh, you were. That's what you did the last time I came on. So
I've used most of them up. So, you know, I'm going to have to talk about. I was hoping you'd have done something else bad since we were last on. But I think everything you've done since you were last on has been good, unless I'm mistaken, unless I've missed something. I think everything is actually all right. So, you know, we'll have to work out on that. I was going to ask you about the chat up lines, which I suppose you've almost covered, but have you had a worst chat up line than would you like to see my penis again? If you're aware, did you ever try? I was never a chat up line kind of person. I don't suppose you were
I was terrible. I couldn't chat anyone up. One time, I did have this horrific experience in LA before I met my wife, where I went out on a date with a woman I had a giant crush on. And I ended up in her house. We ended up in a gay line dancing bar. And wasn't good. And I rented I think I was trying to go through a terrible, terrible, shameful phase of trying to seem like an interesting British man in America. I rented a convertible Mini and went on this date with her and ended up back at her house and got very, very drunk. And at one point said to her, I got bad gas from drinking too much Pacifico beer. And so I went into her toilet because I couldn't stop burping. And I went in the toilet and I was in there for about 20 minutes. And every time I burped, this is so pathetic, I flushed the toilet to cover the sound of the burp. I was very drunk. And I kept flushing the toilet. And obviously then she just thought I was having a massive poo. And so it backfired. And then I came out and I sat down next to her and I remember saying to her, do you think we should kiss now? And she just went, no. And then I remember being ridiculed by people after that. Like, that's the worst. It's just ineffective because it shows lack of confidence.
Do you think we should kiss? I don't know. It's quite charming.
It's charming, but if you're not sitting opposite a woman who thinks you've got diarrhea.
Yeah, true. So things like that can sometimes work and sometimes they can ruin it. Sometimes some people like the kind of obvious spoken and some people think it ruins it if you You know, yes. I've been in the situations where I've ruined it by going, something's going on here, isn't it? They go, oh, you've ruined it now. And then that's, so like sometimes you've got to play it cool and sometimes you haven't. I guess the problem, that's kind of, I'm just watching Seinfeld from the beginning again because it's all on Netflix. And that's very much like the kind of thing that would happen in Seinfeld. And when you're watching Seinfeld, you think, why doesn't Seinfeld just say to the woman, I've got some bad burps and that's what I'm doing in here. I'm not doing a horrible shit as it seems. Yes. But there you go. That's why you don't, because you're sort of worried about it. But I suppose chat up. The problem with chat up lines is that they are, I think looking back in my late 30s and 40s, I was dated quite a bit before I met my wife, and I got fairly good at dating. And the skill of it is it's an improvisational skill, isn't it? To chat someone up. So if you go in with something that's clearly a line that you have, at least that one he's written himself, the Nirvana baby man. but they're usually something like, oh, they're usually like something, get your coat, you've pulled all. I can't even think of a good one.
Those smooth lines, I can't believe it. Yeah. Although I think that the blokes, I used to think the blokes who did those things, they did it by attrition, didn't they? They were just, I mean, obviously some of those guys would now be exposed as having very sinister and horrible. But the whole thing of like, I remember knowing somebody once, it was just like they would just happily go up to 25 women in a bar and try and talk to them until one of them spoke to them. And it was that. And I was always so terrified from the very beginning to ever speak to a woman. So therefore, but I was thinking of that Nirvana man, like, did he not, when he was trading on his babiness, did he ever say anything like, I mean, I don't look like that now. My penis is...
Well, that's what you're...
That's like, that's me. I mean, my penis is bigger now, of course.
I don't think he did. I think he just thought it was cute to, you know, If people knew who you were, because presumably you've then got to go, by the way, I'm the baby from the Nirvana.
Well, in my...
It doesn't even work unless you go, you'd have to go, hi, I'm the, Nirvana, I'm that baby. Oh, that's me. Would you like to see my penis again? And that's too long.
Yes.
But for the joke to work, you have to explain who you are, because he's not a known figure. Mm. So it didn't. I mean, you know, the actual newspaper article says he tried. The lawyer said he tried to pick up women using that, which suggests he never successfully picked up a woman doing that, or it would be he can successfully persuaded women.
I mean, I can promise you, I never used my pot noodle catchphrase to try and pick up a woman, but I did get forced. I did get forced to say it in Cardiff as many times
during sex.
During sex, I got approached during that period of my life in Cardiff by big drunk men with a pint in each hand, those kind of blokes. So Cardiff by night guys who would just say, "Hey, Jim," and then they'd say, "I might have said this on your previous podcast, but like say,
please say it again,
please." But they would say, "Go on, do your catchphrase then." And I go, I'd really rather not say it. And I go, pot noodles, they're too gorgeous. In the voice. And then I go, and I'd have to go, they're too gorgeous. And they go, hey, have a drink. And then they'd make me, and then I go, thank you very much. And they go, have a drink. And I go, you'll have a drink. And it was like, God.
But you could have used as a chat at line, if you could have gone, hi, it's me. You know, you're even more gorgeous than a pot noodle.
God, I want to get in a time machine, Rich, back to Cardiff in 1998 or whatever.
You might
it was.
Have had to go. You might have had to go. Excuse me. Have you seen the pot noodle advert with the little guy? That is actually me. And I just want to say, you're even more gorgeous than a pot noodle. Yes. I'd like to slurp you up with it with a fork.
Yeah, and then that would now come back to haunt me, wouldn't it? Like. Yeah. I was once in a nightclub with our mutual friend Jez Simmons.
Yes.
Around that time. And there was a man, and I got that, you know that weird time when you got recognized, and it's not, you're not massively famous, but you're getting recognized a bit. And I got recognized more for that, just because it was on the telly all the time. And some man kept looking across at me in a nightclub. And I then eventually his mate came over to me and said, excuse me. And I went, and I was ready to go, yeah. And he said, my mate says you're looking at him. I thought, oh my God, I was actually subconsciously looking for somebody to recognize. Tragic. You know? And then I had to explain. No, I didn't. Yeah, anyway. Yes, I never use my pot noodle fame.
To seduce women or to... Well, you got some free drinks out of it from... But not... Yeah. That was... Yeah. They were sort of forced on you, the drinks.
They were, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know. So no, there will be no sewing pot noodle. Well, talking of Jez Simmons, let's talk about this first of all. Because Jez, who I just know as your mate from the pub in Balham, though is a successful comedy writer, writes for lots of... You and he are doing a podcast together, which is excellent. So how this... It's called Brain Cigar. I do recommend it if you haven't heard it yet. Are you only able to do that when you're in the same country, or are you doing that when you're apart as well? Because it sounds like you're in the same country.
We've done things apart. I mean, the last... we did a Christmas special, but then in the actual series, we recorded a load of stuff in London and then shamefully... forgot to make the show, and then we kind of like edited it and then did that remotely, but then we ended up having to record little bits and conversations and links that we hadn't got at the time. But then in my towel cupboard, I had to kind of sit in my towel cupboard with a blank. If you have to do that kind of stuff, you have to put a quilt over my head.
I've tried it, but to be honest, the equipment we've got and the space I've got, it kind of works okay. So I did do a couple of reads for this podcast in that way, when I used to go in a cupboard back there, but it seems to work fine with the setup I've got. So I haven't got to the stage of putting a duvet over my head.
A bit more advanced. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then we did a Christmas special back in, when I was back over in November, we recorded a bunch of stuff there. We went back into a studio and which got like, it's a great thing, but I mean, like with those, the great liberating thing is it literally is something that, it's just really odd, and it's for anyone who thinks it's funny. That's what I love about podcasts. That, like, I mean, you've got a massive, you know, like massive successful podcast with a huge listenership, and so you have a duty of care to your listeners.
I've also got a couple of really, of even more kind of difficult and obscure ones than. I mean, I think Brain Cigar is very much. It's sort of like it feels like a mixture of a Radio 4 and a Radio 1. Sketch show, but allowed to be a bit ruder and, you know, a bit
more...
Which
is weird. When I say, like, knockabout, people can't tell
it's weird.
Mean, what I mean is I'm hugely proud of it, but I also like the fact that because it's a podcast, without people of anyone above us going like, guys, that was a bit weird this week, and we lost four people.
That's why it's a successful thing. But also, it's one of those things people might... But this is true of, and I've said this many times, it's true of nearly everything I like in comedy. The first episode you listen to, you go, okay, I don't know what's going on. And, you know, I know you, so that was less the case with this. So I did sort of know what's going on. But you listen to two or three, and then you're really in the world, and then you've really got it. And it's, you know, it's sort of that slightly surreal thing. My favorite, I haven't listened to all of them yet. I very much liked you trying to get Bono to babysit for you.
Oh, yeah.
When your regular babysitter had fallen through. And my favourite bit, I mean, it's Julia Davis, which I didn't realise. Is it Julia Davis doing all the female parts in it? Is that
mostly, yeah, actually.
She might not have done this one, though, but the review of the funeral.
Oh, yeah, that was
Wales.
Her, yeah.
Yeah, yes. That one really just floored me. That was when, and it's, the nice thing is you sort of walk. I mean, I suppose this is again true of all podcasts, and hopefully true of my podcast as well. But you're doing something like walking the dog or going on a run or something, and then you just get to something that kind of sort of slightly cripples you. You're unable to move because you're laughing too much. But those were two of the bits that. But it's so your relationship with Jez goes back like before even the. Did you know before you met him on an
improv class. I mean, my God, like he's got an incredible, almost dysfunctionally good memory where he's like traumatized. You know, those people who remember everything and they're tortured. And so he remembers specific days. He can remember things like, if you say, what was number three in the charts in, you know, 1994, whatever, he'll know that. But he also remembers, so I think it's about 91, 92, whatever like that, we met in an improv class. But yeah, ever since, we've been in an unashamedly indulgent friendship where we just, like that thing where you just think you met two blokes like us down a pub, you'd find us, and you probably have in the past, but it's quite annoying because it's just this very, very weird world we inhabit where we just find, I don't know, the thing is, And with Jez, it's also like he makes me laugh so much. But also his reactions, you know, his face, like his reactions if I say something really unfunny or stupid, he's kind of like bordering on fury and upset at like what I've just said or what? You know, he once upset a comedian when I was performing at the Ball and Banana, the Bedford. And yeah. And he had this kind of look on his face. And we were in the front. He was in the front row. Oh, my God. I'm trying to remember who it was. But anyway, the comedian had to stop his act. Kind of like during act and say, excuse me, mate. He felt like he was being heckled by Jez's confused face. I don't think he's confused sometimes. He just wasn't. He was confused. Like, the guy was, you must have that as a stand-up where, like, you're not the person's not heckling you, but you're really upset by the look on somebody's face. Does that happen?
Definitely.
To you?
Yeah, yeah. Because you're like as a comedian, you all, and I think less so. You know, I don't do so many like gigs where the audience don't know who I am now, but I do occasionally still.
Yeah.
You know, like because I'm doing my own gigs rather than everyone knows who I am. I don't do those gigs where it's not my audience so much. But yeah, but definitely, you would always when I was back doing stand up, especially in the early 2000s. You would just always see the one person who wasn't enjoying it. You know, you would focus on that person and they would be looking, and especially they're looking miserable or looking confused or upset. Or just and there's every chance they're just pissed off because they've had an argument with their partner or... You're in that position, it must have been, you know, and they're not massively enjoying the act. And you learn to leave it. There was a point where I didn't, like, again, when I came back in 2004, there was one where... a woman was really enjoying it, and then I think I started talking. I started doing some jokes about babies, and this woman suddenly wasn't laughing anymore. Right. And that was very noticeable.
Well, but she then was offended.
I think something bad had happened to her. Oh, you know, but we didn't get to the bottom, you know. So, but then I couldn't leave it, and you know, I was trying to get to the bottom of it, and I was trying to go, well, you know, you can't laugh so much at everything else, and then it's not, you know. It's just a stupid thing to do.
I'm getting involved with this baby thing. But tell me, what has gone on in your life?
It's like you're so sort of self-obsessed in that moment that you're not even thinking that, you know, I don't think I'd thought it through to what it obviously was something horrible. But I don't know if it definitely was, but she didn't want to talk about it. But then, it spiraled out as a result. So I do lots of things there where I'd try and, you know, do the thing you shouldn't do and try to pick out people like that. But it's not. But I think, again, as I've got older, and especially once I've had kids, the idea of trying to even bore some, you know, I used to do stuff where I tried to bore the audience. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like, you know, I don't feel like if it's your one night out this month.
Yeah.
You know, and it's
so life's there's short. Just some. We're of mortality now.
There's just something trying to irritate you.
I won't watch a film. When movies are so bad is good. I think life's too short now. I read loads of reviews. I don't want to waste precious 2 hours. But Jez is the last person now that I have to sometimes stop myself texting him when it's like 8 o'clock here, so it's 4 a.m. with some terrible shitty pun. Just because I can imagine, I laugh imagining him at 4 a.m. I don't like looking at his phone and just going like, what? You know, so on our podcast, like we did a thing at the Christmas special, which was a long story I told him about how, and it was completely made up because our basic thing for Brain Cigar is like to try and tell stories that like try really hard to make them seem like they're true, but they're not. And then, so we did a thing about Bowie dinners in one of the episodes where, like, David Bowie had brought out a range of frozen meals in the 90s, you know, during a fallow period in his career. He just signed himself up to these, like, Finders-type lean cuisine meals. But but to try and do it really, really naturalistically. And so our version of that in the Christmas special was, like, was where I told a story of a man who'd lived 2 doors away from my gran when I was a kid who was never around. And you just assumed he died in the war because his wife was quite old. And then we found out that he was actually a department store Santa. But that weirdly, the local department store, Howells, which was really fancy, and I had a real obsession with quality, once he'd become a department store Santa, they'd made him leave his family and his daughter and go and live in like a little bedsit in Cardiff. But on the inside was decked out like Santa's cottage. And live with an orphaned child dressed as an elf. But he had to live there with the windows blacked out permanently and was never allowed to leave. And obviously he and the child helps went insane, and they were brought out every Christmas for 3 weeks to be in the grotto at Howell's department store. But they had to live in their own filth, like with a bucket behind the grotto, and they were not allowed any. And they were, and then the mother of this, his daughter, the mother used to bring the daughter to see. The only chance she would ever have to see him was to bring her to see him in the department store. And then, but she was not allowed to speak to him because, like, that would ruin the magic for the other children. But anyway, we did this thing, and it was like an hour long. And Jess said, that was just not funny. That was really just sad. That was really, I want to cry. And I thought, it's in. You know? And so we pretty much kept it. So, like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so I felt, you know, it's, yeah. Well, it's interesting, yeah. Because, you know, it is. Jez and you probably wouldn't get a radio show or a TV. I mean, you might now if you went, I want to do a Radio 4 show. They'd probably go, oh yeah, we'll give you one. So you might get a sketch show, but you wouldn't have the carte blanche to do anything you wanted. And and also you're both really great in it. It's sort of interesting that,
thank you.
You know, but you know, that's it. Cause I mean, Jez isn't really seen as a performer at all, I would have thought. And you know, you've done lots of performing, but have become more of a writer.
No, and he's really funny in it.
But it's, he's great. It's really good. So highly recommended. Very good. Well, and you know, are you going to carry on doing more? Cause it's sort of you did sort of six or so and then.
Yeah, we're going to do more. It's a labor of love. I mean, partly it's also cause I write animated movies, and animated movies are like the mathematical opposite, where you write a joke and you really laugh at it, and then 5 years later, you're trying to explain to somebody why it's funny, and you can't remember. Like it's like the most counterintuitive opposite of immediacy. And so it's lovely to do something where you just decide and you make it funny. Yeah. So we're going to do more.
That's what I like about. That's what I've always liked about podcasts, is just that that you can just have an idea and do it in the second. Really, you can do it live, or you can have an idea that day and have it up by the evening time. It's just when you've gone through that whole commissioning process on the radio or TV and know how long it takes to suddenly be able to just get stuff done.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Well, we'll talk about the film in a minute. I just wanted to say that, and I know you know, I had cancer last year, Peter. I just wanted to ask you if you were you delighted when you heard I had cancer?
I was so pleased. I was like, quiet. I was quietly, I wasn't delighted. I was quietly pleased. But I'm sorry you had cancer.
No, sorry, it's gone. It's gone away now. And as I understand it, that's it. That you'll be fine once you've had it. It's gone. That's it. You're immortal, is my understanding. Mm. So it should be fine.
Well, congratulations on your continuing.
Thank you.
Being
I don't want to disappoint. You know, it makes you really think about life and what's important, and then, and for a bit, and then you just go back to being the same and wasting all your time again.
Once they tell you you're all right, you go, oh, well, I won't bother dieting so much anymore than if I'm all
have
right.
You seen have you seen the ecstasy of Wilco Johnson?
No, you did mention this to me I was just reading that front
of just like him finding out. Well, actually, I don't want to spoil it, but like he gets very, very excited that he's got a seemingly terminal disease. But when you see it, it's beautiful. Really lovely.
I'm writing my own book about the situation. I was doing quite well today for a while, so I'm supposed to finish it by the end of the month, Pete, but I don't think I'm going to do that. Let's talk about the film your latest animation, because you've done ones before, but Ron's Gone Wrong. It's about robots malfunctioning. Now, I just want to say, I think you've steered it wrong. I was very disappointed that nobody in this film attempted to have sex with any of the robots at all. I mean, they're not that... A, they weren't that sexy, the robots. Right. But okay. But B, I thought, Ron's gone wrong. It's a robot that's gone wrong.
Right.
There's going to be someone's going to bum the Ron or something.
When you say I went in the wrong direction, it feels like I went in the wrong direction for you specifically.
You can't write a film about the first robots.
You are the first person who's given, you know, is it that just I'm going to have to give it 3 stars out of 5 because whilst I enjoyed the set pieces and the robot comedy, I think it failed on a robot sex level.
I just don't think it's realistic that in the whole of that film, nobody would try and have sex with one of the robots.
But again, they are an egg-shaped robot with, I don't think there's any kind of access area. There's like there's a charging port somewhere, but I don't think that would be, you know.
Well, you know, that's you designed the robots. You could have put a vagina in there. You could have put an anus and a vagina in them.
I didn't. I had no part in their design. But I mean,
okay,
they're very smooth. I mean, But again, this assumes that robots are primarily, or you just what you're feeling that they that you you feel that robots are largely there for as like sex dolls.
Not just that, but that was definitely part of it. And like, also they're all teenagers as well. They're absolutely they'd be trying to fuck them. So I don't know why you didn't put that in the film.
Okay, right then. Yeah,
That's all I'm going to say.
All right, I'm fairly confident on. I do think I know why we didn't put them in the film. Is that it would be insane. And if it had occurred, the conversation with Disney would have been the notes back from Disney saying, we're very happy with the film. However, the scene in the midpoint where, you know, Barney, you know, who can't get a girlfriend, decides to develop a sexual relationship with Ron. It's like, we feel that we can we...
It just could turn a bit dark. It could be quite dark. You could have just a dark bit in the middle. Just a bit of light and shade. That's all I'm saying to you. It's very funny. It's very charming. Okay. It's a lovely story about friendship and, you know, how we can get lost in our devices and how maybe... Yes. I guess...
But you wanted him to get a little... You wanted him to be more lost in his device.
But apart from that, do you think it would be... Do you think it's cheating? I've asked you about Frankenstein before, but I've never asked. Do you think is it cheating in your relationship if you were to have sex with a robot, Pete? If you're happily married now, but if you had sex with or your wife had sex with a robot, would you feel that was being unfaithful, or do you think that's?
I think that would be fine.
Yeah,
and that in no way is implying that I have had sex with a robot.
Okay, sure. Right. I mean, you had to when you were researching the film. You surely had to look into every aspect of what robots can do.
I tried to convince Disney that as researchers of the film, I have to fly to Japan for 3 months to one of those factories that make those, you know, those companies that make those incredibly realistic, but still terrifying women, humanoid kind of things, yes. But they said no.
Look, it's maybe you're right. Maybe thinking about it, you made the right choice, but you know, I
think that implies it was a choice, though. That we sat there in the room and said, we said no, and then we took robot sex scene card down from the wall and sadly put it in the bin because yeah, we didn't. Yeah, I mean, all right. Well, thank you that you feel we made the right choice.
Yeah, well, I'm a viewer. I've never written a film, yeah. And but I've watched a lot of films, so I feel I am an expert on it.
Okay.
And
Are you connecting it to the movie? What's the what's it called? The one with Oscar Isaac. With the dancing, when they dance with there's a sexy dance he does with a robot. That one.
I'm not. I just am obsessed with it. It's just a running joke.
Robots. Okay.
So I just did that for the. It's really. You got an amazing cast, and is that.
Thank you.
Is that something that. Because it's a British made film, right? Mm. This is a British film. Yeah. Me and Sarah Smith, who used to produce Lionel Nimrod's Inexplicable World and The Harpoon and all of our radio shows in the 1990s. She set up a company with other people, and you and her wrote this film. So it's a British film, but you've got quite a lot of a mixture of American and British stars in it. Well, mainly American, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it was like co-financed, and it was like made. There was distributed by Disney, but it had like Olivia Colman and Rob Delaney and lots of brilliant people in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Zach Galifianakis.
Yeah. When you're writing, are you at the point where you think I'm expecting to get those people to be in it, or is it still a nice surprise when they say yes?
No. Still, I don't know why I haven't developed any confidence. I wish I could, and then I wouldn't have to use my pot noodle catchphrase. No, you see, whenever like this, before you cast anyone, if you say, right, like if somebody says, well, what about Zach Galifianakis for the robot part? Like I always felt like really embarrassed and like, what planet am I on that you would think that though one of those people would be in your movie? You know, it just always feels like embarrassing, like somebody's filming this secretly and then they're going to just, that the whole movie has been, the commissioning of the movie has been a cruel prank. You know, maybe it was, you know.
Could be. They've taken a long way to do that.
No, it's really exciting. Like when Olivia Colman agreed, like, what? It's amazing, you know.
Yeah, well, she's so busy as well. I suppose it's, as an actor, I guess animation is sort of a slightly easier job, I guess, in time-wise at least. So it's easier to fit it in. How many days does Olivia Colman work on the film that you've worked 5 years on?
Oh, my God. I don't know. Like, Olivia Colman, if you're listening, I worked a lot more hours than you.
She just waltzes in, does your funny jokes, waltzes
Would it be
out.
Counterproductive to me to attack her publicly on your podcast for not doing as much work as I did?
She could have done some of the drawings. She could have drawn a robot, couldn't she?
So she could have had the decency to come to a couple of sessions. But no, I don't know. Not. I mean, they'd probably do probably about a few weeks. I mean, but they're really, you know, they're really brilliant. Very nice, you know.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Yeah. And cool. Our first session with Zach Galifianakis, he was on Zoom because it was in the middle of the pandemic, and he had to fly somewhere and he had terrible food poisoning. And it was the first time I'd ever heard, you know, met or spoken to him, and we were like on one Zoom and he was on another Zoom somewhere. And he was quite grumpy. And even though he had terrible food poisoning, I remember thinking, he's quite grumpy. never meet your heroes. And then the next session, he was really nice. And I thought, oh, God, I felt bad, you know. No, well, that's really nice.
That's how it goes. When you see those things on Twitter every now and again, when someone will go, you know, who was, name the people who were nice and nasty when you met them in real life, you know what I mean? Yeah. And there'll be lists of people. And I've seen myself, one of them came up when I was both mentioned as being someone who was really nice in real life and someone who was terrible in real life. But I was searching my own name, so I couldn't really say anything about it. Yeah. And but like one of them said, I used to work in Selfridges and somewhere in Notting Hill, and Richard Herring came in and was, but he wouldn't, and I was so, because I thought, I'd never behave badly in Selfridges. I was just really trying to think. I was really tempted to. You know, A, you could just be in a bad mood, you know, like you're in a shop and you might be ill and you might just be in a bad mood. Or it might just be that you went, hey, and I just went, or didn't hear or something. I was so tempted to tweet him and say, what? I don't mind you don't like me, but what did I do that was wrong? But like, if you're talking about
seeing some of one, you know, the one moment you meet someone in your life, you don't know what's going on in their life, or they might not be ready to talk to you. So, like, to make that snap judgment about whether someone's a good or a bad person.
I had a confusing thing a couple of years ago when I was back living in Britain doing the movie, and I was with my daughter Neris, who was, gosh, she's probably like 5, and we were just about to get on the tube train. And when I come back to Britain, I hardly ever get recognised now. It's like, it's hardcore, you know, apart from,
yeah,
it's a long way from my pot noodle glory, Rich, when it was 2 times a day at times, you know. But now, if I'm in UK, on an average, I might get 1 every 6 months when I was back there. I remember getting on a tube train with my 5-year-old, and I was about to get on, and this man ran up, and I was on the train, and this man ran up, and he was on the platform, and he said, like, "Are you Peter Baylor?" I was like, and Neris now tells this story all the time. But, like, he ran up and he said, "I'm a Giant fan. Can I get your autograph?" And I was so, like, in the moment of, like, wow, oh God, I got recognized. And I was quite pleased just because it's so rare that I got a little bit distracted. And I now think I could easily have got off the train, and I have nightmares of thinking, what if I got off the train to sign his thing and the doors had shut and I'd never seen my 5-year-old daughter again? Because she wouldn't have. I nearly cry sometimes. I think, fine, you know, do you ever do that? Like, this is a random thing of, like, you know, think about if you accidentally left your child, your tiny child, on a train, and then I then go straight to how would they feel, and then I start actually crying. Then, you know,
and well, I think a lot about moments where I've nearly done something that would have been life changing for them,
right,
and haven't done it, and then I think about. There was when my son was very little, we had like a harness, and I didn't use it that often. And so he was sitting in front of, you know, he was sitting in front of me on my chest.
Yes.
And just one time we were getting in the, you know, just loading up the car.
Yes.
And I was just, you know, I just wasn't thinking he was there. And I was shutting the boot.
Oh my God.
And usually, yes. It's a hatch, you know, it's like a people carrier. So it's like the big flat down boot.
Yeah,
and I luckily I brought it down. Then I realised, I think I stopped it before it got anywhere near him. But yes. Equally, in that moment, I could have just gone and, like, beheaded him. And I often think about what would your life be if you make a really stupid, tired.
What is
mistake,
it? Like, listen, you're our old mad thoughts. You remember the mad thoughts? There's a special subset of mad thoughts devoted to your own children. And what if I did this and that?
But there's something in your brain where you're just thinking, God, you know. But I think the ones where you've come close to doing something accidentally that would have absolutely completely changed your life and killed your child.
Sounds like an episode of Brain Cigar.
What a horrible thing to think we'll talk about. But you at the same time as doing Ron's Gone Wrong, which again highly recommend. It's on Disney. If you got to the Disney Channel, you watch the Disney Channel. It's also in the cinemas at the moment, isn't it? In the UK, at least. I don't know if it is worldwide. If it's still in the cinema in America, but it's very good, and you don't have to be a child. You don't have to be a child. It annoys me to say it's very good. And also, you again, at the same time as writing that, you were writing for it. You got another Oscar nomination for your work with Borat. But I heard you on another podcast talking about Borat's subsequent movie film, and the man called it Borat's subsequent. He kept on calling it. Is the word subsequent not in American? He was really pronouncing subsequent in a real. I think it was subsequent or subsequent.
I'm glad I didn't notice that. I would have been really distracted.
Do people in America have the word subsequent?
Yes, I did this. I just don't. God, I want to find that out. Is there any way to research that? Go online and go because you go online and go. Who was the man who
I
said
can find it for you.
Yeah, because you can basically find out anything on the internet now, can't you?
Yeah.
Yeah,
you can, but it's hard to do that because that's a pronunciation thing.
It's very specific.
But you were doing that at the same time. Did you ever accidentally write a thing for Borat and put it in Ron's Gone Wrong by mistake?
Yeah, I know. Well, the thing was, Rich, I was writing a movie. You know, I was writing one movie about a deeply offensive, anti-Semitic, you know, sexually predatory character. And the other one, of course, was Ron's Gone Wrong. Do you see how I upended your expectations?
I did. You did upend my expectations.
That is my favourite structure of joke, by the way. I mean, I don't feel above that structure of joke at all. Do you? The old...
I do.
And the other one, well, you really?
You're
a proper comedian, though, so you probably go...
Well, I read an old column of yours today, which is a bit like this, about that you wrote in The Guardian in 1996. This is how deeply I research. You start Monday joke, which is really good about if you're terrible, you can't play music. Is that trope in a sitcom, which is you probably feel worse about this in a sitcom, where and you point this out that in all those sort of Saved by the Bell shows, five times, ten times an episode, someone would go, "There's no way I'm going to go to," and then it would cut to, and it would be there, and the audience would laugh. The same, and it was the same joke five times. But the You Start Monday was one you were.
It's funny, my 8-year-old Neris, the other day we were watching a movie and she spotted it in a movie. We were watching some movie and she said, "Oh, look, she loved discovering." She said, "They do a thing where they say, 'There's no way I'm going to play that song in my underpants,' cut to." And then, but I thought she discovered that trope at the age of 8, and I discovered it. I mean, when I wrote that Guardian article, I was in my 30s. Like, so she's way more advanced as a comedic mind than me. I did think, that's my girl. And, you know, she now loves her. She spotted one way ahead. We were watching Chang'e, The Legend of the Ten Rings, the other day, which is quite fun. Have you seen that? It's quite fun. And she spotted them doing that in that movie way before the rest of us. And I thought, yeah, you know, I was very proud.
Yes,
spotted
nice
comedy structure.
Yes. It's sort of. I mean, that's the nature of writing an animated film. I guess that it's taking so long that you're doing other things at the same time.
We did have, which I have said. I'm sorry if I've said this on other things, but we had a really weird time when we were filming Borat, and I was away filming that on location or in a Airbnb hiding nearby, not actually on set. But when he was filming a scene at a right-wing rally where he got up on stage and sang an offensive song about the Wuhan flu, and I was in an Airbnb nearby, but we were doing a voice session with Jack Dylan Grazer, who plays Barney, at the same time. And it was really weird. Like, I had like my Zoom open and I had two screens open at the same time. And it was just nuts. I was like trying to like say, oh, yeah. And, you know, but I didn't ever go say, yes, I think he should be more anti-Semitic. Can Jack be more anti-Semitic in his portrayal of Barney, please? And then Borat, can you be more lovable?
So yeah. I was interested in that. So as the writer of that, because it's so much of it is spontaneous and dependent on what's happening with the other people, what's going on in the situation. But I was wondering if you would, whether you just wrote a load of possibles or whether you were there at the time. So you're sort of there watching it, and are you able to talk to him and
we're normally there a lot of the time, but we just couldn't be there because it was the middle of course. It was at the height of COVID. So we were like, oh, it was like, God, what was like? Yeah, it was really in the thick of it. So he does do like in a situation like that, he'll do the scene and then he'll go into a huddle and then he'll get in contact with us and say, have you got any more? Have you got any other thoughts? And should I do that again? And the usual answer is no, get the fuck out of there. Like, you know, because he just really like it's nuts. Like, but then we do like, because there's a full script for the movie. There's a full final draft screenplay. And then, I mean, we developed this on the first one where you just like, you develop it. Like, because even though it's like there is spontaneity there, you prepare a whole load of like, say this, say this, say this, say this. But then you say the jokes that you say, but there's also the trigger lines. You try and develop lines to get them to respond in a certain way so that he can come back with something else. And sometimes it's not just about the comedy. You're also trying to get that annoying part of movie, which is about the story. Like every scene needs to have something that propels the story forward. And so we've had scenes in both movies where they're really funny, but they don't do anything for the story. And weirdly, however hilarious they seem in the moment, when you put them in the middle of a movie and then you show it to an audience and nobody laughs at the scene because it's not got any story used to it. So you try and write scenes that will somehow, you know. I mean, the exact, like in the first movie, we had a scene where he meets a bunch of frat boys and we, you know, and they turn out to be, and they were horrible and they were racists and we got comedy out of that. But also we had to have Borat learn that Pamela Anderson was not a virgin from that scene. Yeah. And so we had to engineer a thing where he shows them the DVD case and says, I'm going to marry this woman. She's a virgin. And they go, oh, dude, she's not a virgin. And then he had to learn from that scene. So yeah, it's a lot. Yeah. It's loads of writing because you're writing not just the lines, but you're writing lots of different contingencies and, well, if this happens, then we'll do this. If this happens, and we've reshot loads of scenes as well because they didn't work, you know.
Yeah. So where were you when Rudy Giuliani was attempting to masturbate in the hotel room? or so it appeared. Were you sort of somewhere in that hotel watching?
No,
it
I wasn't like... because again, it was like because it was a COVID time. But also, I was actually in Northern California with my family in a tiny hotel room. And we were back there recently and I was watching it at one end of the room on a live YouTube feed where like you could create, it's very low tech. You basically create like a live YouTube link and nobody has the code for it. So I was thinking somebody could potentially accidentally stumble on the, what the hell's this going to be? But I was with this room. I was in the room with my wife and my two girls. And then I was watching it live. And then it's all going down. And then he starts to lie back on the bed and take down his, you know, undo his belt. And I called Sarah, I said, quick, come in quick. and Ruby's going, what is it? Nothing, nothing. And then we told them to go on their iPads. And then and I said, oh, my God. And then we were back there during Thanksgiving at the same hotel. And I was saying to Sarah that there should be some really obscure memorial blue plaque on that. Because we walked past the room where we were staying. And I said, it was like a motel ground floor room. And I said, there should be a plaque saying Peter Bainham's co-writer, like at the thing, watched the, like it's the most meaningless blue plaque ever. Yeah. So, yeah.
So yeah. If he'd started masturbating, basically Sasha kind of came in fairly quickly to rescue
him. We were worried about so many scenes in those movies all the time.
Yeah.
Like A, about what could go wrong, but also could this be gross and horrible and disgusting and whatever. And, you know, Maria, who played his daughter Tuta, was amazing and ballsy and so like just was there and just brilliant. But she was super brave. But we also had to go, because they had to be on their own, you know?
We thought
if it goes weird, it crosses over into exploitation and something you don't want to actually be involved in actual human trafficking. That would be, and we don't want to be the Jeffrey Epstein of...
But it's, it's treading a line both in taste, which obviously like, for everyone saying you can't do anything anymore, I mean that film really pushes boundaries and I know, and it's ballsy. It's dangerous for the performers, you know, to an extent. Yeah. Certainly when he's putting himself in amongst, you know, the kind of people who, you know, from the news we've seen, can just start shooting people they don't like, or you know, or certainly fighting people they don't like. Mm. So there's a real element of danger there, and it is pushing boundaries of taste. In an artistic way, but if you had much pushback, given that everything's cancelled now and you can't say anything anymore due to political correctness gone mad, it seems you've been nominated for an Oscar for Oscars and the film's done pretty well despite all of this. But is there any feeling that because he's anti-Semitic and obviously that's the joke that he's an awful anti-Semite, have you had much blowback from being accused of being anti-Semitic yourself?
I don't think it ever really rationally can be accused of being anti-Semitic, given that Sasha's Jewish and has been on the record as, you know, as wanting to expose anti-Semitism. But on the other hand, I don't think that those problems have gone away. And actually, there was weirdly, that we didn't do much anti-Semitism in the second one. Or much. I don't think we did. Like, there was a few things in there. But because the thing was that in the end is that we'd done one of my biggest worries wasn't so much that it would cause offence, because I think it was, I don't know, unless people are being wantonly missing the point, I think it was generally pretty clear what the satirical targets were in the whole thing. But on the other hand, I think I was more worried about, you know, as a comedian, you're always worried about going back to that well twice and just being repetitive, and, you know, there's a graveyard of sequels, movies that have, like, gone back and just been rubbish. You know, you're just scared of, like, it being rubbish. Or, yeah, things... And also, I think it was, like, there was a worry that we're treading... Like, obviously, in that movie, one of the scariest things was what would people make of the scene where they do the dance, you know, when she does the whole period dance, you know?
Right, yeah.
And I remember, like, before we rehearsed that, I was worried because I was in the room. I'm the really, like, canary in the coal mine. I'm the real Chicken Little, quite often going, I don't think we can do this. It's like, it's just 2000, you know, it's 2020 now and we can't do this thing. But what changed my mind on that one was that we had a rehearsal and we were there with Maria, and she was so fucking funny. And did it so, and we realized that the key to that was, because in the danger is you got a bunch of male writers. I mean, we had female writers on this as well. That was really important. We can't do a movie about a man, you know, and his daughter, and how his daughter discovers feminism, and even Borat becomes, it's a terrible word, woke, but becomes a bit more woke. But you can't have a bunch of just men writing that. That would be crap. And so there were female writers, and it was a female writer's idea to do that whole scene in the first place. But I was still worried about it. But then what we realized was that she just owned the scene so much, and the way she danced was so, like, proud and just like, oh, it's their culture. So the joke ends up being on the people who were offended. But yes, yeah, so you're always worried about, like, with that movie, like, can you do this stuff now? You know, I was also, you know, understandably, I was also worried that, like, isn't it time that people, and there was a little cancel Borat campaign at the time from people in Kazakhstan. But weirdly, the government of Kazakhstan, who are now literally right now being, you know, this horrific things happening in Kazakhstan right now. But when the second movie came around, in the interim, they had a whole, advertising campaign saying, come to Kazakhstan, do business in Kazakhstan, or come here for your holidays. And I think they even used Borat. The first movie, they were outraged by it to extent that helped publicize our movie. But you've got to be aware of that it is also like it's another culture. And like we're in a time now where, you know, understandably, you've got to be careful about any cultures, you know.
I think it does. You know, but it's challenging. I think it's not. It's great because it's challenging and it's, you know, and that's interesting. It's good that it's nominated for Oscars. I'm not saying it shouldn't be nominated for Oscars. I saw the film Bad Trip. Have you seen Bad Trip?
Is that Eric Andre? No.
Really love it. I really, really love it because it's the same sort of idea. But he basically goes out and shows how nice people are by doing stupid things, and then people help him. Mm. And you kind of think, you know, they're two very different films and they're two very different approaches to it. But, you know, that sort of joyously life-affirming, funny film without any political intent would never get nominated for an Oscar, even though I'd say it's as fun. I'm not saying it's better than Borat, but I'm just saying it's different than Borat. Right. It's sort of, you know, it's kind of hard, I don't think, to do, as a comedy writer, to do gloriously, absolutely just laugh out loud, funny stuff that doesn't necessarily mean anything. But that stuff never gets nominated for like the big Oscar awards, does it? Comedies, it's almost seen as like this inferior thing, and you know, if it gets close to being serious, then it can get some awards.
But I know what you mean.
Just, you know, Spinal Tap is one of the greatest films ever made. I don't think it, you know, it maybe won some awards, but I doubt it did because it wasn't really successful for a few years later. But, you know, like, it's sort of weird to, it's weird I that I think, But as a comedian and as a comedy writer, being funny is the hard. Being serious is kind of easy, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and the funny
writing
thing
a film about Nazis is easier than writing a film about a robot that you don't even have sex with.
No, I get annoyed every year. But like, did you see the movie? Did you see the Adam Sandler movie called Uncut Diamonds or Uncut Gems?
No, I haven't. That's one of the rare ones I haven't seen. I just started.
Brilliant. It was really brilliant, and I think he should have won the Oscar for best. It was, like, but I do think there was some subconscious. There was something going on that, like, I don't know. Some people just probably thought, well, he's Adam Sandler. He does all those Adam Sandler movies. Yeah. And I think there was something that he just didn't get there for that. I saw a movie last night with my family called Coda. Have you heard of this movie? It's really beautiful little movie about it's a British actress actually, but it's about Coda stands for Children of Deaf Adults, and she's just a girl who's got like her parents are deaf, but it seems like one of those movies that you would just see. Like on, you know, just a little movie about a sweet moment. She wants to sing but it's so beautifully brilliant done. And I think it deserves an Oscar nomination, but I don't think it'll get nominated for anything because it's like, well, maybe, you know, maybe I'll champion it. But it's just really, really nicely made movie, you know. But yeah, I know what you mean. It's like, well, it has to have it has to tick another box, doesn't it? So a pure comedy struggles, yeah. You're right.
And, you know, like, there's a big scene in Bad Trip where he's being fucked by a monkey, like a man in a monkey gorilla costume in a cage. And that's the kind of thing that will never get nominated for an Oscar, but it's much funnier than it sounds. But also, it's so lovely because it's basically all these people are trying to help him and, you know, and a shot, awful things happen to him and mainly people just try and help him. And it's kind of nice to see especially right now, it's sort of nice to see that side. As in, you know, but your film potentially, possibly altered the presidential race, or at least maybe influenced the presidential race. So, which Bad Trip almost certainly didn't, unless people really took against the being raped by a monkey.
By the way, I did a Guardian article last year publicizing Brain Cigar, and I was asked like, do you think it altered the race? And I said something like, we did our bit.
Yeah.
And I'm forgetting. And I just said, we did our bit. But I didn't really think it did, you know. And I was really pleased with the article, except the headline in The Guardian was, we did our bit to change the race. It was like...
you know, but no, potentially. I mean, it was one of the things that, you know, like, because also... That's there, you know, it's there on film. And you can argue about what he was actually doing and he can argue about what he's actually doing, but it's still so dodgy, isn't it? And he is so dodgy. I mean, they're all so dodgy. So it's like, it was an incredible thing. Now, I think we did talk, there's a few big turning points in your career. I don't want to keep you for too much longer, but I wanted to talk about this because, and we talked about one of them last time, which was that Sasha rang you up and said, I'm looking for someone to write on this film. And you said, I'm doing my own sitcom at the moment, so I'm not interested. And Jez, again, your friend Jez was the guy who said, what the fuck? Do you ever think about how your life would have gone had you not rung Sasha Baron Cohen back? Because there's a film in that. It's the new sliding door. Because that, you know, I think you'd have gone on and had a terrific career of some kind, but that is such a pivotal moment, right, in your life.
Yeah, I only think about that every day. Only every day.
Literally, you'd made a decision, and it's only because you met up with someone and said, what are you doing the next night, that you went back on that decision.
Yes. I had that bit in movies, that cheesy bit in movies when the hero sits up in bed, so suddenly, you know, goes out. You know? 3 a.m.
But there's a few of those kind of things in your career as well, because the reason, which I don't know, I just saw this today and I don't think you've told me this before, but the reason you sort of got into the day-to-day, partly having again turned Armando having rung you up and asked you to come back and work on Weekending and you go, no, I'm doing a sitcom and not going back to work on Weekending, but you then missed out on maybe being some part of On the Hour and everything as a result, because he sort of got us from Weekending and everything. But then you came back in on a Sunday to the BBC like Entertainment Fund to steal some photocopy paper.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's when you met Armando properly. Yeah. Right.
Making up offensive lyrics to singing Frank Sinatra songs. Making up songs about necrophilia in a Frank Sinatra style, and in the photocopy room of the Radio Light Entertainment department. Yeah. And then the funny thing was, he didn't ring me up for a very long time after that. And weirdly, I mean, in between, I mean, that did lead to that eventually. But in the interim, I had that weird thing where I don't know, where basically I had that encounter with him. And then after that, my Merchant Navy sitcom, which I got to say, Armando has said, go on record to say, and I made two separate pilots of it, The Men of the Charlie, my Merchant Navy sitcom starring Brian Blessed and John, have we talked about this before? And John Pertwee.
I don't know. I sort of vaguely remember it from the time.
John Pertwee is a mentally ill man who lived in the engine room.
Right.
And then we recorded it again. We talked to his spanners. And we'd just say, yes, this is my darling. My Dutch is my love, your darling. And then we recorded the pilot again. And then John Pertwee wasn't available. I don't think he died, but he was like very, very old. And then I think he was replaced with Chris Lynham, the comedian who used to put a banger up his arse. Do you remember him?
He's just been a guest on. I've just been talking to him. He's actually the last week's episode, gone out.
He didn't mention that. Very, very weird. And Anita Dobson playing Brian Blessed's wife in both failed pilots. But Armando has said, basically in his very Armando nice way, that it was one of the worst things he's ever heard. he didn't say it was terrible. He just said, I didn't understand it. It was so, but not in a good way. You know, somebody says it was really weird, but it's a good, it was really weird in a bad way. But anyway, so I went off to, that's why I said no to him to come back to do weekending. And I went off and did this. And I remember one time being, it was after the second pilot. And do you remember all those strange old men who used to be the executives? Those kind of old confused men who'd all go to the pub around the Yorkshire Grey. And this old posh man came up to me, not Jonathan James Moore, who I think, God rest, I think he passed away, didn't he? But one of those other men, I can't remember his name, came up to me after they'd had their meeting and listened to my Merchant Navy sitcom pilot, and said, this is a cut too. This is a You Start Monday. Because he literally came up to me in the car and said, just heard your pilot. Well, there's no way that's not getting a series. And Peter Wayne's life, the cut too, was like, it's not getting a series. Like,
You
don't start Monday. You stop Monday. But in the meantime, I'd run up a lot of debt, and I'd done things like The Harpoon with Sarah Smith and Julian Dutton, and I'd done this, and I'd quit weekending, and I had like about £5,000 in debt, which was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah,
Rich,
was.
I'll have you know. And was. Still a lot of money. Still a lot of money. And I was very poor, and I had a job, and I went to I was living in Ealing, and I went to a job agency, and I was due to start in a call center. And then they said this was the You Start Monday. They said I'm not making this up. I was due to start working in a call center on Monday. And then I got a call from the producer of a show called Friday Night with Wogan, which was Terry Wogan's weekly non-live riposte to I think to the Jonathan Rosses of the world. And he'd stopped doing his three times a week live show, and it was a recorded.
Okay.
It was an edgier version of then they rang up and said, "Do you want to come and write Terry Wogan's, little Irish puns with three other writers?" Yeah. And I said, "Yes." I said, "I will start Monday." And I remember ringing up the agency and them really being angry at me. They said, this is not good enough. We can't. Okay, fine. And then I did that for 6 months, and then I got the call.
Yeah.
to go and work on
but
the day to day.
But it's sort of interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's how the life is, and I think when you're looking back at life, we've all got this stuff like this. But these moments that Chris Morris sort of when you were suggested as a writer for the day to day, Chris Morris was sort of saying, "I don't think we need any more writers," and nearly. Who you would then go and work on it with as well, you know. So if he'd gone, we don't need this guy, then would
I hate work yeah those things Chris? Really upset me because I you find with those things like it, there's been loads of others like where I used to be crippled by that because I used to think if I don't do this thing because I look back and I go so many things are like chance encounters.
Yeah.
Have you ever had that? And then if you think too much about it, then you're really frightened to walk out the door.
Well, you sort of just realise that you only have to change one thing.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, even, you know, that your children wouldn't, you know, you change one thing anywhere.
Oh, God, yeah, that's really upsetting.
Your children, you've got different children, maybe with someone else. And, like, it's so stupid because you would love whatever those children were just as much. But you're sort of thinking, but I wouldn't have these extra special kids that I've got. It wouldn't be as special.
Well, I'm so...
Every little change, yeah.
Well, I'm so rubbish. You know, I was so rubbish with relationships and as we've talked about the chatting up of it all or the meeting people, and I was so terrible at it that I think that the one that involves me coming out, you know, to Sasha saying and me then going to Jez and in the pub I think in the Bedford in Balham and saying to Jez I've said no and because I'm going to do this thing and him saying are you crazy and then me going oh shit I am. And then me ringing up and leaving a message, or like speaking to Sasha the following day, that leads to me coming here, and then that leads to me meeting Sarah, my wife. And if I'd stayed, it's not just like, I think I would have carried on working, you know, probably, but I wasn't in I had no work at the time, so maybe I wouldn't have. But yeah, and I don't think I would have, I don't know. It's a really upsetting. Think about it.
But it's also there's so much of you in like as in terms of unsung hero of comedy the last 30 years, so many things that people would recognize as almost the main thing, you know, the main thing of Alan Partridge, the first thing people would say from the series I'm Alan Partridge would be Monkey Tennis, which is you, right? And there's so many things, the running of the Jews from Borat as you. You know, there's so many things that people would pick out and you've worked with and they all talk very lovingly of you correctly. Mm. You've worked with Steve Coogan, you've worked with Chris Morris, you've worked with Sasha, and you know, your comedy and have improved all those people. And had such an influence. I'm sure something would have happened unless maybe you would just say, I've had enough I give up. I mean, we've seen writers do that. We know writers who might have stuck it out, who didn't stick it out. So I suppose it's possible. But I can't really think of anyone who's had as much influence as you have throughout all comedy. What do you think? Because you've been sort of at the centre of four or five like major things.
Thank you, and
at the center of it because you've created the thing that people love about those characters as well, so it's not surprise. I think you would have somewhat if you'd said no to Sasha, he might have come back to you another time, you know. He might have even been like, oh, this guy said no to me, I've got to really up my game to get him to come in next time. So something would have happened, I think, certainly by that stage. But it's interesting,
I don't know that, but he does ask, you know, I now know that like when I went in there that he'd there was a bit of, this is quite funny, because there was a kind of a line of bodies out the door of other people he tried, you know.
Right.
So it wasn't like, and I, that's the thing as well. I also like, I'm also relieved. Well, do you find that I'm relieved with the things that have gone right and the right choices I made, but I'm also very glad on several occasions of my life to have not known the full truth of what was going on.
Yeah.
Because that might have really frightened me. The weird thing but is, when I got here for that particular thing, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to Hollywood, I'm going to LA and all this stuff. And I got here and he'd broken his foot and the director had quit. I wasn't told any of these things. The director was gone and he was in some really shitty office somewhere, and it was sharing it with some guy who let his dog run around shitting on the floor everywhere. And it didn't seem like any of it was going to last very long. And it was like a real, in the short term, a real come down. And we spent 2 weeks, and he said, and they tried to basically go out with the, they basically tried to go around, the original iteration of Borat, the first Borat movie was, the director had wanted them, and they tried this. The director said, no script, we're just going to go around America, and I'll be the, I'll interview you, and I'll be on screen. And this is Todd Phillips, who then went on to make The Joker and loads of other huge, huge movies, and The Hangover and stuff. But that was the way they were going to do it. And it hadn't worked, and they'd gone their separate ways. But then, so it was like we had to sit down and write a story. We decided to try and write a storyline. We spent 2 weeks in a room writing a storyline. And I think I had 2 weeks on the clock of like, this is how long you're going to be in America. It was my contract. And then we got to the end of that 2 weeks and we gave the scripting. And another You Start Monday. We gave it in on the Friday. And then he went to see the studio on Fox on the Monday. And he came back and he said, they hate it. Well, and I thought, and I remember thinking, yeah, so that's all like, cause, you know, it's just every day is the same. Like every day is like, don't you find just every day is like, none of these things are set in stone ever, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
At all, like, I'm feeling right now like a little bit like, shit, am I done? You know?
Yeah, you know? Well, you know, but you do, but you go through those things. I guess what's interesting about all that as well, though, is I'm thinking, you know, I was thinking of it, where would Peter Bainham be if he hadn't gone to that photocopy room or hadn't taken that call? But what's interesting is where would Alan Partridge be and where would the day-to-day be and where would Chris Morris be and where would Sacha Baron Cohen be? Because in that instance, if you hadn't gone and worked with Sacha, maybe Borat... I mean, again, I don't think Sacha would have disappeared from the scene completely, but you never know. But Borat might not have been... You know, Borat might not have happened and everything that came from that. So actually, you know, we should be saying, what if it's them that's been all those people who have... been lucky enough to work.
I mean, you're saying the world basically falls apart if Peter Bain.
Well, apart from Fist of Fun, which you know you didn't make any fucking difference to, and it didn't help either way.
Yeah, he would have survived. Did you have another sneaking man lined up?
We'd be the only comedy show in the world if we hadn't put you in Fist of Fun and you destroyed it. I think you made no difference to Fist of Fun in terms of success, but in everything else.
Yeah.
In everything else, maybe Peter Bainham, maybe they should be thanking their lucky stars that you were stealing photocopier paper.
Do you know the pot noodle of the famous pot noodle campaign? When we did that, they wanted to make people think pot noodles were, have I told you this before? They wanted to make pot noodles seem healthy and good for you.
Yeah, I definitely know this.
And it was really complicated campaign where they, and then 2 years in to the campaign, they did research and they came back and they did the research came back as like, pot noodles are really bad for you. That's the message. We failed, completely failed in the message. And from there, they leaned into the, this is just crappy food for students and men in bedsits. And they went, they gave up trying to make them. So I feel that I did have my effect on pot noodles. Well. I helped pot noodle be honest.
So pot
noodle's
still going because it would have finished without it. So they are. You can still get pot noodles, and a snack like that does not necessarily last through the ages. So yeah, I think it's all down.
I think pot noodles like Marmite. It would have been like there's no point in advertising Marmite or pot noodles. They're just a constant. They, you know.
Yeah.
There's people so buy like them anyway.
You're like a Merlin figure that you just come in and this may go back beyond the 1990s, back through the medieval times. You may be an immortal being who just comes in and helps people become successful.
Yes.
And I'm frankly annoyed that I worked with you and you did not weave your magic on me and make me.
Well, let's successful. Do another one. So thanks for that. Let's do it again.
Let's do Fist of Fun again.
Yeah.
We'll try it again. We'll try it again now, knowing what we know. Let's do a movie of Fist of Fun.
Yes.
That's what we need.
I see no barriers to that. I see there's no complications in anyone's relationships with each other.
Just have to green screen.
Is there not? Can we not do a Get Back? Is there not footage we can do a Get Back? You know, the Beatles, the brilliant Beatles thing. Do you think Peter Jackson would be prepared to spend millions and hundreds of millions of dollars getting the footage from our rehearsal sessions?
They might be, you know, but there was all the studios, that went on for so long. So there is loads of footage of mainly me, Stu sitting there looking sullen, and me doing my best to keep the audience going. I think we must have had a warm-up, man, but and I wasn't doing stand-up at that time.
Yeah.
And I think I just sort of took over this role of trying to keep the audience entertained. And we did they were so long, those things. So, I would like that, because I'm very much the Paul McCartney. Very much the Paul McCartney of Fist of Fun. Yeah. So people would look at it and go, "How is Richard Herring was doing all that stuff?"
I was Stuart was the John Lennon.
Yeah.
And then I was the Ringo. I want to be the George Harrison.
Kevin Eldon's probably George Harrison.
Yeah.
Sally Phillips is Yoko Ono.
Yeah.
It all works out.
Yeah. Now we've run out of Beatles. But
Alistair McGowan, Kev did we did a sketch with the 13th Beatle or somebody, or the 8th, the 9th Beatle or something, where he'd worked out he was the 9th most important. Anyway, let's not talk about that. Look, we've gone on for way too long, and I know you've got lots to do. So I've come to the conclusion that you are a Merlin, making nearly everything good. Everyone should watch all of the stuff you've done. Brain Cigar, if you've only got time for one thing in your life, Brain Cigar should be that thing that you put in your life. If you've got time for two things, also watch Run's Gone Wrong. And if you haven't got time to watch a film, then, you know, and listen to six episodes of a podcast. Now, I'm not interested in you being in my... Listen to this. Listen to my podcast first.
Are you firing anyone from your listenership?
I'm going to fire you.
You have a shred of decency.
Look, is there any? Do you not know what's coming up next, really? Or are you going to do more animations? Are you going to do more?
No, I'm writing a live action film, which I'm waiting to hear right now whether it'll get made into something. Set at a wedding, but not a romantic comedy. Okay. An Altman-esque comedy set at a wedding. And then other things. Yeah, but
good.
I'm going to be mysterious.
Good, you should be mysterious. You've done all right, Pete. You've done all right for a boy from Wales. You've worked your way up. And, but also it is true that you are, that...
And you?
It is possible. Well, but you've... You were in the Merchant Navy. I know it was a mistake, but you were in the Merchant Navy. You could have gone a very different way in your life. I was always wanted to do comedy I didn't have much more of a leg up. I was a headmaster's son, but I was, it was at least a possibility. Whereas I think, you're a working class lad who's found your way to Hollywood.
There's a long story behind my dad and his.
But you're working class. If you work in the Merchant Navy, that makes you working class, because that's all the Merchant Navy is a working class job. So, in any case, it's possible with a bit of luck, steal some photocopy paper, have a mate who tells you when you're being a dick in the pub and tells you to ring back Borat. But it's possible. So it's very inspiring. Keep going, Pete. It's always love to talk
to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the amazing Peter Bainham, king of comedy.
Thank you.
He's the king of comedy. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Peter Bainham. The music is, of course, by Scant Regard. I'm indebted to my friend Chris Evans, not that one, who set up all of the necessary stuff to make this remote podcast work. I'm also indebted to Ben Walker, even though he didn't have much to do with this particular episode, but certainly helped us out by editing all the ads and all that stuff. So, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. That's what I would say. Thank you very much to Peter for joining us. Thank you to Ian Zoom for allowing this to happen, and Ian Zencaster. They're very good guys. Do become a monthly badger, gofasterstripe.com/badges. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz on gofasterstripe.com production. Come and see us live. It's going to be fun. richardherring.com/gigs
for more details. I love you all. Richard Herring out.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.